Welcome to our little workshop on what I like to call sustaining recovery. I always like to start everything I ever do, first of all, by telling you my name is Nancy Beecham. I am a compulsive overeater and a 100-pounder from the city of Los Angeles. Thank you. I came to Overeaters Anonymous in 1976, which means that I've been a member of Overeaters Anonymous and standing for 34 years and maintaining 150-pound weight loss at this point. I always begin by saying that Overeaters Anonymous did not open up the gates of heaven and let me in. Overeaters Anonymous opened up the gates of hell and slowly, very slowly, began to let me out. And that's where I'm coming from. I would like to begin also by dedicating this workshop to all the alcoholics and OA members who have gone ahead, to the ones who have shoveled out the dirt and laid the trenches, to the alcoholics and overeaters who trudged ahead to make recovery so easy for those of us who truly want to work for it. I just had to walk in the steps they had put down. I had to walk behind them. Until I was able to work the steps well enough to catch up to them. I had to develop the self-worth to no longer walk behind them, but one day to finally, as I do now, walk hand in hand as an equal member of this fellowship called Overeaters Anonymous. I also learned that when I came to a workshop such as this, I had to do a very important thing. I had to learn to give God, it was maybe, February, and I was very concerned about who I might go out with New Year's Eve. I had to give that to God. I certainly had to give my grocery list for Sunday afternoon to God. I had to give away my children. I had to give away the job, which was terrible anyway. God forbid that should go away. I had to learn to give these things to God. And I'm so grateful that as I began to get a little bit more silent, and as I began to learn to get a more quiet, but I heard these great gems that the initial woman in Overeaters Anonymous were teaching us, to just take my hand and to slowly put in all the things that would keep me from hearing what's said today, to put in my bad food plan and pray for a new one, to put in the fact that I'm resistant, all the things that keep me from recovering that I'm thinking about today, I put them in here. And then I put in my other hand all of that resistance, and I put in all of that unwillingness, and I throw them up to God. And then I get to do is I get to be here now. And that, for me, was the beginning of my 11th step. And I also want to talk to you about the fact that I'd like to dedicate this meeting today to all those who have died. In 34 years, I've seen so many try to get abstinent. I've had so many young women in my heart and in my hands. And I've sat at funerals of people, and if scaring people got them well, it would, but people with diabetes and people who lost arms and legs and people who got in car crashes while eating their donuts. I remember clients at an AA meeting once saying, I don't know what to do with these fat people because nobody ever got arrested for being under the influence of bingbongs. Well, the truth is, I went to jail because I was so desperately lonely, I ran around with heroin addicts, and I helped them roll both across the border. I don't know if any of you have been so big or so ashamed or so lonely from this disease that you were willing to do anything to call anybody your friend. But that's where this disease took me. So it's with that in mind that I dedicate this to all those who died for us to live, who died to show us that we have a chance here today to learn some great things to move our programs forward. Lastly, I get a lot of serenity and courage and wisdom by rereading constantly the doctor's opinion in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think it's very important before we begin any workshop, before we go to any event today, to think about two things. In the doctor's opinion, it very clearly states, you must be completely abstinent. Now, that is an AA book, and they do use the word abstinent. It says, in order to work these steps, you must be completely abstinent, which calls for a lot of rigorous honesty. So for those of us who don't have food plans or sponsors or are kind of knowing we're eating what we shouldn't, or at a point where maybe we still have another 25 pounds, or maybe we should be giving up that brown rice and those noodles and that bread, you know, and maybe we're having a little resistance. This book says that you're completely abstinent. Only then can you work the steps. Or if you don't work the steps, how do you get the promises? If you don't get the promises, how do you get the purpose of recovery? Which to me, I believe, is to carry the message. Because I'm not a whole, healthy, happy person, and that's what I have, you know, except the sex. So if you're going to really carry the message and get anything out of here, it says in the beginning, you must be completely abstinent. And I wish to God that every workshop, and every big book study, and every thing about body image would start with that. You know, because it might be an important thing. If all you did today was get out and get a sponsor, you'd be on your way. And the other thing it says is that we need a fight for recovery and get happy, joyous, and free when we die. Now, I don't get this. Happy, joyous, and free, death and insanity. Where is the choice? Where is this going in and out? I know that at this moment they're doing a thing on relapse. I never got relapse because it said I was going to die or go insane. And then it said happy, joyous, and free. And I was willing to trudge and fight and go through hell on earth to never walk away from this program because happy, joyous, and free seemed a lot better to me than die or go insane because my father killed himself and my mother ended up locked in a mental ward. So my chances weren't too good of being happy, joyous, and free. So that's just something I'd like to start with to kind of clear the air. Because in the beginning, Roseanne turned to Alcoholics Anonymous and the woman of Al-Anon. Roseanne, who sponsored me for so many years, gave me this gift of meeting Chuck C. and sitting in Clancy's house and going to the 50th anniversary of the big book, which was held at the Laguna Art Bowl, and we stood outside for hours back in the middle of the Rose Parade, you know, and overnight, you know, it was like this big, big event, and I met all the last people who were in the big book who were still alive at that time. And to me, the exposure that I had, and April and I both growing up from Los Angeles, we had no idea until I started to travel the World Service and I met people from all over the world. People, when I talk sometimes on these phone lines, they only have one meeting or they slowed in, and God, we have so much. But so very few of us stood up last night when we asked for over 10 years. It just got diminished down to 10 people. And that's very frightening because this is open to every one of you. So, they told Roseanne to practice the principles, that if she learned the principles and the steps, so I think it's really important for all of us to consider if we know the principles and the steps. Because there'll be no recovery here and no slowing down until we change our behaviors. So I'd like to share with you, and it's all written on a handout that was graciously prepared and helped for me by Sandy M. from the Valley. I want to thank her so much for all of her input and help. Step one, honesty. Step two, are we living our lives completely hopeful and full of trust? Step three, do we have lots of faith and lots of commitment? Step four, do we have courage? Step five, do we have integrity and trust? Step six, do we have willingness? Step seven, do we have humility? Step eight, brotherly love and responsibility? Step nine, do we walk with justice and compassion? Step 10, perseverance. Step 11, spiritual patience. Step 12, are we doing lots of service and charity? But first, are we doing it to ourselves? So as we adopted these as a basis of conduct for ourselves, our lives began to change. I want to tell you the reason that this is fairly scripted is that this was done originally as a two-hour workshop at the 50th anniversary of Overeaters Anonymous. And the response from World Service, you couldn't get in the room because the majority of people at that convention had a real lot of time and they were hungry for this kind of a workshop. And April and I have gotten requests from every country and all over the world to do this into a retreat. And so we're doing this today to kind of record it again and to talk because we know that we have a lot of more people here and we're excited about your input. So I learned from now on that I can share many things from the past that I was ashamed of. I got to be able in Overeaters Anonymous to talk about going to jail, about stealing, about raging, about abusing my kids emotionally. You know, I have these two little babies and I was their only custody. When I came to OA, when you took away my food, you took away my arms and legs. I was like a wild person out there. I believe that it takes, according to statistics of Alcoholics Anonymous, it takes 45 years to get the food out of our system. It takes something like 5 to 10 to really begin to learn the steps. That's just to comprehend the steps. Somewhere between 10 and 15 to practice the steps. And somewhere towards 20, you get well enough and calm enough and quiet enough to really do those inventories that hit the meat, that really hit some of the basis of what recovery is all about. Because two things for me, if you can, this is not about Overeaters Anonymous. I sat here for years worrying about what to eat and worrying about when I should have my apple and worrying about what I could have at the restaurant. And the truth is, I needed to shut all that up. To just get a food plan from a nutritionist and just do it, and to get on with the business of why I'm here. And that is, without switching to another addiction, like men or being in a job or I'm abused, to end with chaos in my life. Because truly, more addicted than food, I'm really addicted to chaos. I have to be up or down. I just can't be uncomfortable. And so what I learned when I got to 20 and 25, that I was now ready for these very famous Joe and Charlie workshops. And I was ready to take a year of my life, and one more time. I had to give everything up. I quit my job. I did not get remarried. I have children in my life that are very toxic to me. I didn't talk to anybody for a year, and I just worked on recovery. You know, I just went to work, stayed quiet, and I moved because I was ready for a whole new life. And I have to tell you that I'm 67 years old, and I've had a lot of health issues. After a mastectomy, I had a bad implant that viraled out to a toxic nervous shock. But yesterday, and I always love people who are well enough to talk about what they're doing right now, the article came out, and it's going to be all over the television station. There's a new procedure for this thing called atrial fibrillation. And when you're on any kind of blood thinners, you can't eat broccoli, you can't eat vegetables, you know, your diet is very limited. And more importantly than losing a breast was the idea that I might gain weight, was the idea that my abstinence could not stay healthy, that I couldn't eat what was suggested for me. So I got snuck into a clinical trial at St. John's. And the truth is, I got a chance to be interviewed because our councilman, Bill Rosenthal, just had this procedure. And I'm a point person for this, and I'm telling you, I'm all over the place talking about how I'm in a 12-step program for losing weight, and I have to have a healthy abstinence, and eating what I eat is the most important thing in my life. So any way I can, one day at a time the rest of my life, my obligation will be to think, God, this thing happens to me, how can I make it work for Overeaters Anonymous? How can I help some newcomer who reads this or sees this on television to know that there's a way, no matter what? No matter what, when everybody says to you, you have to gain weight. And I said, but I won't, you know. And I didn't, you know. And this is the thing that's so wonderful, you know, is that every horrible thing that's happened to me, by the time I got calm enough and quiet enough, I get to turn around to be a wonderful thing to help somebody else. So my past now has no guilt or no things to be upset about, because I get to use them as vehicles for recovery. And that's a pretty good gift. So, moving on, the 12 of 12 of AA says that only the dying will work the steps. They're just too hard because we're so resistant to change. Prayer and meditation gives me the strength and the courage to plow on through. I later learned to become, and I did say later, those of you that know me know it was much later, to be silent and to live in the now. What great gifts are prayer and meditation. For somebody like I, who's on the street with two kids, unable to function at 300 pounds, what a great gift to live in Sierra Vista among the birds and have our own place, and to walk with dignity and be able to live alone, to be calm and quiet and present. My God, what could one ask for? And this is the change of prayer and meditation. Three years about a great husband and a great trip to Europe and a great job at the studio, but three years about calm, quiet, and being present. Silence is the goal for me. It's the goal of the 11th step. Silent enough to be able to hear what God says to me. Our workshop today is about sustaining recovery. I want to dedicate the rest of the days I have on earth to getting more people to have long-term recovery. We just have way too few. It's about maintaining joy and maintaining peace in our lives. And now I share with you, before I turn this over to April, Drop the Rock, a fable that 50 years ago was told to Rosanna Alexander by one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. Soon there was this group of 12-step members taking a boat ride to an island called Serenity. And it was truly a happy bunch of people. As the boat pulled away from the dock, a few on board, Miss Mary was running down the street trying to catch up with this boat. One member said, "Darn, she missed the boat." Another said, "No, not. Come on, Mary, jump in the water, swim. You can make it. You can catch up with us." Mary jumped in the water and started to swim for all she was worth. Swam for quite a while, but she started to sink. The members on board, now aware that Mary was struggling, shouted, "Come on, Mary, don't give up. Drop that rock." With the encouragement, she started to swim again. But she started sinking again shortly after. She was going under when she heard all those voices shouting, "Mary, drop the rock. Let go. Drop the rock." Mary was vaguely aware of something around her neck, but she couldn't figure out what it was. Once more, she gathered her strength and started swimming. She was doing quite well, even gaining a little on the boat. But then she felt this heaviness pulling her hand again. She saw all those people in the boat holding out their hands and howling for her to keep swimming and shouting, "Don't be an idiot, Mary. Drop the rock." Then she understood, when she was going down for the third time, what the string around her neck was. This was why she kept sinking when she wanted to catch the boat. It was the rock they were shouting about. Resentment, fear, dishonesty, self-pity, intolerance, anger were just some of the things her rock was made of. "God, help me get rid of this rock," she prayed. "Now, get rid of it." Mary managed to stay afloat long enough to untangle a few of the strings holding that rock around her neck, realizing as she did that her woe was beginning to ease up. Then she had another burst of energy and she let go. She tore the other strings off and she dropped the rock. Once free of the rock, she was amazed how easy it was to swim, and she soon caught up with the boat. Those on board were cheering for her and applauding and telling her how great she was, and how it was so good to have her with them again. And now they could go on with the boat ride and have a nice time. Mary felt great and was about to indulge in a little rest and relaxation. But she glanced back to shore. There, a ways back, she thought she saw somebody bobbing in the water, and she pointed out to someone. Sure enough, somebody else was trying to catch that boat, swimming for dear life and not making any headway. In fact, it looked like that person was going under for good. Mary looked around and saw the concern on the faces of the other members. She was the first to lean over the rail and to shout, "Hey, my new friend, drop the rock." I learned that from now on I can share so many of these things with everybody in recovery. The 10th step has cleared away the wreckage of my present, which for decades I kept going in this program. If I kept getting new boyfriends and arguing with my children and changing jobs and never being happy, I had to constantly work on these every day. I had no time to work on what Overeaters Anonymous is about, going up, back, and cleaning up my past. So the 10th step began to clear away the wreckage of my present, and I can move on to step 11. For me, prayer and meditation has made me quiet enough and calm enough to begin to work on all those character defects of mine that kept popping up and dropped the rock. In order to achieve lasting abstinence, I need to have those principles we talked about. I need to incorporate them, the principles in every step. I can get a great job, but I may not enjoy it. That's not good enough in Overeaters Anonymous. All these ways sometimes to get judged or to get fired. I can lose 150 pounds, but I can struggle to maintain the weight loss. Instead of living cuddly, like easily and peacefully, like I've learned to do now. I can get in a relationship in order to have any permanent, healthy, that's a good word, healthy, lasting relationship or job in my life. In order to be happy or to enjoy anything, I have to have serenity. May this workshop help you discover that lasting serenity and peace for each and every one of us truly and really is possible. And now, my dear special friend, April.
April and a compulsive overeater. Thank you so much for coming today. I really need you all. The 11th step is sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood God. And that's a step that I stayed far away from for many years. And then I'll go into it in a second, but I just want to tell you how we came about the title of our workshop. The theme of this whole conference is football, about which I know nothing. So being a writer, I went online and looked at all the terms in football, and we came up with intentional grounding. We thought that was a pretty good term. Yay for intentional grounding. So for those of you who don't know me, I've been in Overeaters Anonymous since December 1975. I was in college. It took me 6 years to get abstinence. I marked my abstinence birthday as February 11th, 1981. So February 11th, it'll be 30 years. And I lost between 50 and 60 pounds. My abstinence is about, it's changed. My abstinence started out just hanging on to what at that time was the gray sheet and the orange sheet, which was three meals a day, nothing between, and then certain weighed and measured food plans calling it in. It has morphed and moved and changed to very strict abstinence, which worked for me for a very long time, to when I was pregnant having to let go of that, and that was very frightening after 10 years of very strict abstinence. In my first year, having lost a lot of weight, right towards the end of that first year, I began to gain a lot of weight, and it was very, very frightening. I felt so imperfect. But I had help from sponsors and people around me, and it really does take a village. My husband says it takes me a staff. I need a staff. Is that another staff member on the phone? And these days, for about the last 7 years, triggered by a very uncomfortable argument between my sister, my only sister, and myself, I realized I just needed something to obsess about that was not my sister for a little bit. And I tried counting calories, which was a complete horrible idea to me. It was something that I never would have done. But I just needed something that was detailed, that would take me away from being so frightened and angry about our interaction. And that has proved to be quite miraculous for me. So here's what I do today. My abstinence is complete honesty. No sugar except if it's listed for below, except I do drink if it's served somewhere else. It's soy milk that has, I think, sugar fourth or something like that. It's like cane juice, evaporated cane juice, whatever. And you and I know that the barbecue sauce in restaurants is probably sugar first, but okay. So complete honesty, I tell you, I tell meetings, no sugar. And every day I write a journal entry, essentially, a 10th step, and I send it to my sponsor, Barbara B., who lives in Montana, who has lost 120 pounds 30 years ago and has kept it off. In that 10th step, I write five things I'm grateful for every day, and I write every single thing I ate. And that's where the honesty comes in, because there are some days, you know, I tally the calories, not something you have to do, it's just for me. And for me, what that has done for me is take me out of denial and put me in reality. I can have anything, but I just have to look at it and go, do I really want to use that many calories on this? That's all. It makes me, and when I have to report, she doesn't care what I do. She could care less if I send her my food. It's just something that works for me, which at the end of the day, because I know I'm going to send it in, I really think about my food during the day. Do I want to have this and tell her about it? Because absolute honesty is the bottom line for me. It's the bottom line. What I've learned is absolute honesty doesn't hurt as much as I thought it would. So I can come into a meeting and say, you know, you would not believe what I had for lunch yesterday. It was really a lot. And I reported in, I'll tell you what I ate. Okay, so I'm going to just tell you about the handouts that we have for you, and then you can set them aside because you don't need them, because that's why we have them for you. So, for example, the yellow sheet has practical wholesome meditation on one side and some research about meditation on the other, some of the things that is proven work. So it's just interesting stuff that I found was useful to me. The lavender sheet has two things we're going to actually do today. You do not need to look at it today. You can look at it to remind you if you want to carry it in your own practice. The white sheets are Nancy's, including a very thin strip of this wonderful set-aside prayer and a lot of other helpful things. The structure of this workshop is that we're having this introduction right now. In this introduction, right after I finish this part of my introduction, I'm going to lead you in a meditation. Then we're each going to talk about how we use meditation in our lives. We're each going to talk about how it changed us. And Nancy's going to end with a meditation. We're going to close with a serenity prayer. If you want to stay around for the questions, you may. But since we will have closed the session after that, you're welcome to leave quickly. So that gives you some flexibility in terms of time. And the first thing I want to say is that when I first started hearing about meditation, I thought, does anyone have to meditate for an hour? Because I'm not going to do that. And what it means is I can meditate for 2 minutes. I think it's really important. Just like when I started to abstain and I was calling in my food and the best I could do was like sour cream or something, it was fine because eventually it became cottage cheese or whatever. It doesn't matter. I just have to start somewhere. And it doesn't ever have to be longer than 5 minutes if that's what you have. So for me, everybody is different, but I have to set a very low bar for myself or I won't even start. My overriding mantra is, I'm in exactly the right place, doing exactly the right thing, and doing it exactly right. That goes for anything I'm doing in my life, and it goes for when I'm deep in meditation, or when I'm not able to get deep in meditation, when I'm sitting there going, what? I'm in exactly the right place, doing exactly the right thing, and doing it exactly right. So, what I've learned about meditation is that, what I've been taught, is that meditation is not a mere sleep state, it's very much energized state. And I was taught to do some quick exercises ahead of time to begin. So I want you all to stand up and put all your stuff aside. And each thing I do, we're going to do three times. So I'm going to say a quick phrase, just so you know what the phrase is. Then we're going to all repeat the phrase and the motions that I make. Again, when you're home, you can learn this from the lavender sheet. So first thing you're going to do is you're going to march in place, and you're going to say, I'm awake and ready, I'm awake and ready, I'm awake and ready, I'm awake and ready. Then you're going to say, I'm positive, energetic, enthusiastic, and this is what it looks like. I'm positive, energetic, and then jump, enthusiastic, if you can jump. I'm positive, energetic, enthusiastic. I'm positive, energetic, enthusiastic. One more time. I'm positive, energetic, enthusiastic. And then, this is fun. You're going to wrap your knuckles all over your body, up and down, especially in the tops of your hands and the tops of your legs. And this is what you say. You say, I'm the master of my body. I'm the master of myself. We're going to do that three times. I'm the master of my body. I'm the master of myself. I'm the master of my body. Does it feel good? I'm the master of myself. I'm the master of my body. I'm the master of myself. And then you're going to rub the same areas and you're going to say, awake, rejoice, my body cells. Awake, rejoice, my body cells. Isn't that great? Awake, rejoice, my body cells. Awake, rejoice, my body cells. And then you're going to wrap your scalp lightly. You're going to go all the way down to the base of your brain, and you're going to wrap it lightly with your knuckles, and you're going to say, be glad, my brain, be wise, be strong. Be glad, my brain, be wise, be strong.
Be glad, my brain, be wise, be strong. Be glad, my brain, be wise, be strong. And the last thing you're going to do is you're going to massage your scalp as if you're sort of lifting the skin, and you're going to say, awake, my sleeping self, awake. 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 So that's the energization exercises. Then I say a really quick prayer. I'm going to say mine. I made it up. I'll say it with you. You can make yours open. What I say is, Mother, Father, God, thank you for making us candles, for lighting us, for sending us out into the world, and thank you for bringing healthy people into our lives who will light us too. You can make up anything you want. So then the second part that I learned, also from the same teacher, is this is called the circle of joy breath. So what you do is you put your hands, your two thumbs together, and you rub your heart chakra, and I'm going to just show you this first, and then we're going to do this three times. You can try it. And so I rub my heart chakra three times, and what the point is, I'm drawing a circle around myself, and inside I put health and joy, or whatever you want to put in. So I take in four breaths, and out, four breaths, in four breaths, and out four breaths. And as I circle, I'm putting in whatever it is, health and joy, and out four breaths with a hand behind me. Feels really good this way. And then back to the front, and then back to the heart chakra. That's one. So we're going to do this three times. And just relax, bring in the breath, four times each time, right? You might want to close your eyes. Rub your heart chakra. One more time. I guess speed it up at the end, sorry. Okay, now you can sit down. What I do generally is I'll sit on a prayer or meditation pillow, or I'll put some pillows around my legs so it's comfortable, but it doesn't matter. I think sitting will be fine. I'm going to now take you through a quick meditation. There are a lot of different kinds of meditations. I don't pretend to be an expert. In fact, for those of you who remember Mario, he taught this about 20 years ago at a meditation at a birthday party, and I have never meditated before, and it still works for me, this one. But there are a couple of things I do, and I'll probably talk about them later, but one of the things I do is, if none of this works for you, and if you're not even with me and I say picture this and you're like picturing something else, it's fine. Remember, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, and doing exactly right. So whatever comes to you is fine. Just letting go of judgment is the most important thing. Sometimes I'll think of the letter O in God, or in love, or in hope, or in Obama, sorry. And I look through that, and I just try to find, you know, they say that meditation is listening. So even though the guided meditation is really fun, there's a lot of stuff in it. And that may not be enough listening for you. So generally I just try to see through that O, maybe to ocean waves, or maybe to a cobalt blue moon in the night sky over a hiking trail. And everything else goes away. So there's a lot of different kinds of meditation. You can do meditation online. Just Google in how to meditate, and you'll find lots of ways. People are very generous sharing. So the first thing I was taught to do is think of something, and you're going to close your eyes. Think of something that makes you happy today. Generally for me, that's our fairly new dog. He's lanky and licky. He's too tall.
And when I'm asleep in the morning, he puts his nose against my nose and says, is it time to wake up? And when I think of him, I'm very happy. Think of something that makes you happy. Now you're in the top of a carpeted stairway. Maybe you're bare feet so you can feel the carpet. Maybe you're in comfortable shoes because you are going to go outside. So right now you're on the top of a comfortable carpeted stairway, any kind of carpet you like. And we're going to take a breath for each stair, and there are 10 stairs. But I'll lead you through them, so you're still up there. If while we're talking, I get to the bottom before you do, then your stair only had 8 stairs or 5. It doesn't matter. Okay, so at the top stair, 10. Take a breath and lower yourself down to 9. Take a breath. Lower yourself down to 8. Breathe. 7. Six. Five. Four. Three. Two. One, you're now in the foyer of a lovely house. There may be light coming through windows. There's a front door. It's a very pretty door. It's the door you want to make. It may be wood. Maybe anything you want it to be. You open the door, and outside is exactly where you want to be. Maybe your grandmother's garden. It may be overlooking a river or a creek. There may be a meadow. Maybe it's night outside and the stars are out and you're warm enough. You walk outside into this beautiful space with lots of growing things. You're breathing quietly. You feel so comfortable. And you start to walk along a path. As you walk, far in the distance, coming towards you slowly, you see either an animal or a child. Something that makes you happy. You keep walking towards this animal or child. All alongside the path are beautiful things, maybe things that smell good. Maybe there's a breeze. You're walking towards this. You're curious. What is this thing walking towards me for? You're about to reach this animal or child. And now you're very close. And this thing gives you a gift. You don't necessarily have to know what it is or why. You do. You see what it is. But you don't necessarily have to understand why you've got that thing. You thank the child or the animal. And now you turn around, holding your gift, and walk slowly back on this very beautiful path, feeling curious and thankful until you come back to the door. You open the door and walk up to the stairs, and with each breath you ascend. One, to three, four, five, six, seven, eight, the stairway, and you're slowly coming back to awareness, and you slowly open your eyes. And all today I encourage you to think about what that gift was and why you have it. The other day I tried this again and I had a corn cob crown on my head. I have no idea what that was about, but it was the weirdest thing. The first time I did it, my animal was a deer, and it gave me a white feather. I'm not really sure I know what it was, but it gave me a neat feeling. Can't tell you. It was just a neat. So that's one guided meditation you can do for yourself easily if you're too chaotic inside. And now it's time for Nancy to speak, and I'll be back. Thank you.
Part two. One thing I did want to mention is that for me, absence is very different. For me, because I couldn't sit still, because when I went to St. John's, I was horrified when the nutritionist said to me, a portion was my fist. Because what I saw was this very big bowl that I literally sat on to press the cucumbers and the tomatoes to get more and more and more into my first years. So for me, as time went on and age came on and things happened to me, also, I got a little more into life as things went on. And when I did that, it was necessary for me to make a very restrictive abstinence. So I am very grateful. I hear people all the time talking about, I hate that ratio. It was horrible. Yet they did it for 10 years and they're still here. So I believe that anything that was part of my recovery that I did helped me, and I should be blessing it and not accusing it. So for me, weighing and measuring and getting narrower and narrower in my choices have made me a lot of freedom. I feel like a butterfly that just can fly out there, because I have been so restricted that it's narrowed my choices and it becomes easy. So today I brought you a concrete example of show and tell. This restaurant last night did not have healthy choices for me. And I know that we've worked very hard, because I live across the street in Playa, and we've worked very hard with the local restaurants. Like Diner now has steamed spinach and broccoli, and took a lot of us really writing letters to them and really carrying on to get some healthy choices, to get some wheat toast, some regular turkey, real turkey. But they have all that now. These changes are made after a lot of people not liking us, but we were willing to sacrifice for the cause, you know. And the point now is that last night I just didn't eat, and there's several of others in this room I know who may be diabetic or may have other issues, is that we just went home and ate appropriately what we needed to do. But today I didn't want to get in that trap. And I know that they've arranged a little salad bar, but I understand that it's a soup and salad bar and no protein. But you see, I have this because from the very beginning of LA, I always carry an apple and a can of tuna in my purse. And in those days, you had to have a can. But the truth is, if you were really serious, you'll learn to have a can opener too. And that's the difference that separated a lot of us who stayed here for 10, 20, 30, 35 years now, is that we're willing to carry that can opener too, willing to go to any lengths. Made a big difference. But for me, like, I have four proteins, like tuna, turkey, salmon, and chicken, of course. And pretty much that's what I do. And a lot of steamed vegetables and a lot of salad, because things, you know, the rubber's gotten there and it's tightened up, and the doctor said they're going to make it very easy for me as far as measuring this brown rice and the noodles and all these, because we came out with more and more things that sounded really good for me. But the truth is, for this body, who easily gains 150 pounds, wasn't so good. He said, we're just going to drop all that stuff. You're going to have a piece of whole wheat bread a day, and there's certain grains that I get to incorporate in that are very important to have, and a lot of vitamins. So, you know, this is just what I do, which is very different than what April does, which shows you that there's room for everybody. But I have to tell you, it's such a relief and so simple. I don't have to think about it or worry about it. I just have to call ahead and carry a few things with me. It's no big deal anymore. My abstinence isn't about, we were reminiscing about how when I was new that I remember going to a restaurant and a bunch of OA people had some garbanzo beans and some regular dressing, and I wouldn't even sit at their table. I was so afraid I would catch it from them, you know, and they were all so wrong, you know. So how I use meditation in my life. Why do we bother with prayer and meditation? Why does prayer and meditation do for us what is so critical that it's a maintenance step? Why is this convention that is so full of new people have so very few people in this room? Why do we wait so long to get the very thing that's going to sustain our recovery? Because I know at the at the 50th anniversary of OA, you could not get in the room because the average recovery there was probably 25, 30 years, and people had come from all over the world to get this kind of thing. So I think everybody that's in this room, especially these three men, you know, to be among all of us. I think that we owe them applause, and I think you ought to tell yourself, good, you know. I think it takes a lot of courage to sit here and not be where the fluff is, you know, to be where you're really taxing yourself and learning something. So, for me, meditation had to begin with some very simple things. As I told you, my food had to be simple. My meditation did. So what I did in the beginning, even the kind of thing that April did today, I couldn't have sat still that long, not for a very long time. So they talked to me about trees, and they told me that if every hour of the day I could go outside and look for a tree outside where I worked, or if every hour at home I'm sure I could walk around and find in the season rose blooming. And they kind of tricked me, and they told me that God was the good in the world, and so if I could go out and I could see a tree blowing in the wind and those leaves, I would know who's making those leaves grow. But everywhere I go, in any country, in any state, in any city, during any trauma at any time, in a restaurant, if I'm on a date, and, you know, if I got into the kind of things I would get into, where I met some engineer at work, and he asked me to go to lunch, and he really wanted to meet my girlfriend, you know, and devastating things to me. Because I went to Overeaters Anonymous, and I went from 300 pounds to 275, you made me a speaker, and I thought I was terrific. But I walked in there, I was a fat slob, and people weren't so nice to me, you know. And so I tried to do things often based on the fellowship here, allowing me, I believe, to get too well too soon. I just did not have my first 5, 10 years even. I had no business speaking. I had no business sponsoring, for me personally. Because the truth is, if I was sponsoring you and doing your inventory, and I saw something interesting going on in the next room, I was out of there to go to the next room, and I just abandoned you. Didn't mean to, didn't know that it was destroying you or hurting you. I didn't have any of these principles in my life yet, you know. And the truth was, it took me a very, very long time to get being there for you. I couldn't even look anybody in the eye for a long time. So the truth is, I'm realizing now how slowly I need to trend. You know, I'm learning new things and incorporating them. Sometimes I think I know something when truly I've only been maybe just acquainted with it, but I certainly don't have any expertise in it, you know. In other words, giving advice on abortions I can do, giving advice on mastectomies I can do, but giving advice on diabetes, I've never had it. But what I do know is plenty of people that do that I can guide you to. And that's what makes to me a terrific sponsor, is somebody knows what they don't know, and they know other people who do know, you know. And that for me took a very long time in recovery to make those kind of networks. So I hope for every one of you that at the top of your network, your sponsor's sponsor or their sponsor, your grand sponsor, is somebody who's really grounded in this program for many years, that you always have somewhere to go in a trauma, you know. And without realizing, day by day, I started to look for these leaves. And I remember times when things would happen, when something like when my father died, you know, and my first reaction was to use this as an excuse to call off everybody that I ever knew. And to begin with, I wanted to lose weight, to hurt every man that never asked me to dance. You know, I had a hit list of everybody that ever rejected me, and I was going to go get them all when I got thin. That, to me, was what this was about. And, you know, my goals for myself, I talk about low bar, where I remember telling a great legend named Chuck Sue in Alcoholics Anonymous that I couldn't wait for this OA thing to just have this thing work for me, because I was going to go down to a bar by the airport where everybody used to hang out, and some man there was one day going to ask me to dance, even if it was in the dark. And they always saw my size, and nobody ever did. And he said to me, "Well, I hope at that time you'll be well enough, my dear, to consider the source." He's probably a married man for a weekend popping into town. You know, "I hope you'll be well enough to begin this and consider your source," you know. And that's what recovery does sometimes. It goes, ouch, the goal I had wasn't so good. The job I was trying to get was very unhealthy for my abstinence, you know. The person that I'm with and that I love, that I'm married to, that couldn't be love. He's not even that kind to me, you know. And the truth is, what am I doing to protect myself? You know, do I have my own bank account? Could I take care of myself if I stopped living with all these men? And the truth is, maybe my kids would have been better off to begin with, you know. I never thought that a mom and a couple of little kids could be a family. It just never occurred to me. It was always trying to get somebody else to do that for us, you know. And, of course, it was a disaster. And I really want to throw in one thing, is that I have these daughters who are now in their 40s, and they're very sick. You know, one is a professor at Stanford. You know, the other is running half of Spokane, Washington. She just got she's up for the Business Woman of the Year in the state of Washington. And they're both now gained 100 pounds. They were cheerleaders. They were always quite thin, you know. And they are both married to the children of alcoholics. And they're both very demanding and very difficult, and neither of them are talking to me. The weller I get, the worse it gets. And I had to make the conclusion that in my home, I moved to this new beautiful place where it's only wellness, and people get to come in that are respectful and kind, and there's just no bad memories there. And I've created this little place for myself, you know, where it can be meditative and trees and birds and just beautiful things. And people that are crazy don't get to come. I'll meet you at Coffee Bean, or I'll meet you at the restaurant, or I'll meet you at the beach or take a walk, but you don't get to bring that into my home. And that's been a lot of growth for me. And it's all come from this. So I learned to simply observe my breath. That was all. It worked well to keep negative thoughts at bay, to always be able to stop and just be aware of my breathing. I came to Overeaters Anonymous, and I was going to all these doctors to get atomizers because I was always choking and I had very sensitive airways. Come to find out 25 years later in Overeaters Anonymous that I never breathed properly because I was always gasping and always frightened and always full of fear, and I didn't realize what I was doing to my body. And it's true what we heard last night. You do pay a terrible price. It's called the vestige of your fat. You know, alcohol and food are exactly the same. One is liquid, one solid, they're sugar. And there's a book called Sugar Blues that I highly remember, you know, do recommend, that was given out in all the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous in its first 20 years. And we all had to read it, and it talks about how in the old days they would give people sugar because they had no anesthesia for dentists and for sugary. Imagine that. What we use just to calm ourselves and to have a little treat to get through the day. Anesthetize people for major surgery. It works that well if you get the right combination. And this is what we were doing to ourselves, and have a hard time stopping yet to trade it for happy, joyous, and free. Doesn't make a lot of sense. For the first week, it was very difficult for me to sit quietly for even a brief time. My mind, like an inquisitive monkey, jumped from thought to thought. I was rebelling at the unfamiliar stillness. And that's what we're talking about here, is working through this unfamiliar stillness. But I kept at it, and the hyperactive monkey, finally, after years and years of trying, has settled down. And the miracle of recovery has happened. I have actually begun to now savor those quiet times. And wasn't that amazing when I had them left to me? I held on my abstinence for life. Because the very fact that I'm doing the very best I can for myself, the very best abstinence in the world for somebody who's 200-300 pounds, every day of my life I know I can get through anything. It just gives me strength, you know, to abstain in a food plan that's appropriate for me, that's been checked out by doctors and nutritionists, and not to have this little game play, you know, that, well, I'm going out with these people and they're eating bread and butter and I'll just have a half a piece of bread. That would be okay because they're eating. It's all over, you know. And that's kind of what happened, that in the stillness and the quiet of learning to be with myself. And it simply started by going out and looking at the leaves blowing on the tree. We had an amazing woman named Doris S., who was one of our great legends here in Los Angeles of Overeaters Anonymous. She died our reigning sex sponsor at 93. And Doris used to have these workshops in her home with a man named Al S., who still often does them for Alcoholics Anonymous. And, oh boy, she had these lemon trees. And she would talk about these lemon trees. And lemon trees just sit there. And they have a lot of lemons, and some are brown and some are bruised, but you know what? They're fat, they're short, but they just kind of hang in the sun. And they just kind of were there, and they just have a good day. And eventually, they kind of wither and fall down, but they live their life. And we're not like lemons, you know. What am I wearing? Does she have something nicer than me? Is she bigger? Is my toe too big? And now should I have the surgery on my ears, you know? And it's like a great miracle happened to me as our dear Jack S. talks about the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah has a dreidel, which says, Mishkabal HaYasham, which is a great miracle happened there. And for those of us of that faith, we always, I think, believe that a great miracle has happened here to us, you know? And the miracle is that, like that lemon, you know, that will get you just hang out and enjoy our day, and that's the goal. And it's these simple little things that I do that are meditation to me. So we kind of wanted to give you the idea about how formal it gets to and how important that is, but how any day, no matter where you are, there's a guy named Bobby E. who actually wrote some very famous movie sets. And at the time, he was toothless and living in his car, and he went to AA, and I believe he founded Adult Children of Alcoholics. And Bobby went to work on the set, and all these men from the Roxbury Wednesday night Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, they got him the shirt. And I swear to God, this shirt said, fuck it. Mm-hmm. And every hour on the hour, it was his 11-step assignment. He was to go outside to the bathroom and sit on that stall and read that shirt out like, fuck it. And that would be his meditation for the day. Because that was getting him quiet. And he could understand that. And that was the language of the street. And little by little by little, the shirt came off and it got